It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Sandy Rios coming to you live from CPAC 2018, National Harbor, Maryland. This is the place to be if you're a conservative in the United States right now. The Vice President of the United States speaking Thursday morning, the President of the United States speaking Friday morning, every media outlet known to man here covering it. So whatever media outlet you watch in the next few days, you're going to be seeing something about CPAC, and I'm sure news will be made out of the things that are said, and there will be many, many words spoken, especially here on Radio Row. And I've asked a good friend, another good friend, do I have the best friends in the world or what? I do. Hans von Spakovsky is with us this morning. He is a senior policy advisor at the Heritage Foundation, and Hans was with the Justice Department under President George W. Bush.
That's right.
Right, Hans?
Yep.
And was it Civil Rights Division?
It was in the Civil Rights Division.
Oh, boy, that was... was it as controversial then as it is, as it became under Obama?
Well, yeah, but for the right reasons. The left got very upset, for example, when we approved without objection Georgia's new photo voter ID law, and the same thing in Arizona, and that got people very upset.
How radical.
Yeah, isn't it radical, right?
Hey, you know, we can't launch into this discussion without an update from you on that commission. You were on the voter commission with
Christian Adams
and others, Ken Blackwell,
right.
And
Chris Kobach
from, yep, Kansas. Is that completely disbanded?
Unfortunately, it's completely disbanded. The president issued an executive order dissolving the commission in January. And while I'm disappointed, I mean, I understand the reason for it. One, we weren't really able to do what we wanted to do because about a third of the states were refusing to give us any information or data about, you know, their voter registration lists and things like that. Without data, you can't really research and analyze. Plus, progressive advocacy groups on the left had filed almost a dozen lawsuits against the commission, and the very lean staff we had, basically frivolous lawsuits, the staff we had was spending 100% of their time defending the lawsuit. So it was almost impossible for us to be able to operate.
But there are other ways.
Aren't, yeah,
there other ways?
Well, you know, I work on election issues all the time from my perch at the Heritage Foundation, and we have other organizations working on this, like, you know, our good friend Christian Adams, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, which is in the midst of, for example, suing counties that have more people registered to vote than the census says they have population.
Is True the Vote still actively chewing the vote?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to them in a long time, so I don't know how active they still are.
So there are other, but nothing like this commission would have been. From,
right,
top down with,
right,
the authority to do what they needed to do.
And I think that's why it was attacked. The left, yeah, didn't want the kind of information coming out that we might have been able to show, like, you know, people voting in more than one state and things like that.
Hans, I'm thinking, I wish we had the clip, but the president, when he was still, President Obama, when he was still president, made this boastful comment, this harumphing comment about how no one could ever co-opted the American election. That's ridiculous. Nobody believes that,
right,
anyone could ever, you know, interfere with America's elections. That's really not true, is it?
Well, no, but it's kind of funny that he said that, and yet what's been going on for the last year now, you know, an investigation, people on the left claiming the Russians somehow influenced or meddled with the American election.
Yes, which brings us to a topic.
Right.
Just a few days ago, within the week, there was an indictment announced by Acting Attorney General
Special Counsel Bob Mueller.
Oh, I thought Rosenstein made the announcement.
Well, he had a press release about it, too. He's supervising Mueller.
Okay, so the indictment is being brought by Special Counsel Mueller of these
yes.
Russians?
Yes.
All right. Well, yeah, Rosenstein didn't make a public statement about it, so I thought he was the one. All right, so this comes out of the Special Counsel's office, not the DOJ?
Well, they're part of DOJ, but it's the Special Counsel's office. And it's, no matter what people may think, once again, it's not any evidence of what Mueller's supposed to be investigating, which is supposed collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. No, these were 13 Russians who basically used social media platforms to try to sow chaos and raise social unrest in the U.S. by making comments about things like immigration, the Black Lives Matter movement, and at some point they would criticize and oppose particular candidates. For example, they put out tweets criticizing Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. They, at some point, were supporting Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, and Jill Stein. But at the same time that they were doing that, other times they would be critical of them. So the idea that they were just working to try to help Donald Trump get elected and Hillary Clinton defeated is just not the case. I'll give you a quick example of that. After the election, through Facebook and other social media platforms, they tried to organize and get people to go to two rallies in New York. One rally was to support Donald Trump as our new president. The other rally was, the theme was, Trump is not our president. So it's clear this was to sow chaos. This is nothing surprising. The KGB used to do this all the time throughout the Cold War. They were known for their disinformation campaigns, and that's what they were doing.
So the idea, if you were a KGB agent and you got into their head, was to just throw confusion, just to cause confusion for the purpose of what?
To cause social unrest in the U.S. And a key thing everybody should keep in mind is that the indictment, 37 pages, which I had to read, makes it very clear these Russians did everything they could to keep their identity secret and to make sure that people thought they were Americans. They created fictional American personas. They used stolen identities. So none of the grassroots organizations or campaigns that were contacted had any idea that these were really Russians in disguise contacting them.
All right, so Hans, isn't this what the Chinese do? Is this what the North Koreans might do if they had a presence here?
Yes.
Is this what Iran might do?
I mean, isn't
this really what spies and foreign enemies do on the regular basis?
It is. And a short paragraph in the indictment that I don't think anybody's reported on was a paragraph saying that this was not just being done in the U.S. by the Russians. They also did it domestically in Russia. And they also were attacking other countries. They don't say what other countries in the indictment, but it's very clear this was a worldwide operation to basically spread Russian propaganda as much as possible and to cause social unrest in other places.
So the thing that I just don't understand is, look, not that we'd be happy about that or relieved that that's the case, that they do it everywhere, so no big deal. I'm not saying that, but it just seems odd to me that this special prosecutor, whose task is to show collusion between the president
right.
and his team and the Russians, would indict foreign nationals. I mean, do we indict spies? Do we charge them in our courts of law
with
spying? Do we do that?
Yeah, we do. But look, there's never going to be a trial because these folks are in Russia.
Here.
They're not here. You know, they're
so
never.
So what is the point?
I think this is a way of Mueller justifying his existence when he ought to be concentrating on the task he was assigned. Was there Russian collusion? Not a single one of the indictments so far has had anything to do with that. Remember, there was lots of publicity some time ago when a guy named Paul Manafort was indicted because he was briefly a volunteer with the Trump campaign. Well, that indictment had nothing to do with the election. He was indicted for his dealings with the Ukrainian government.
Many years ago.
Years before the election.
So what's... Do you think Mueller has anything? And how in the world could a reasonable man justify, you'd think even on his own, he would shut down his shop if he doesn't have anything.
Well, look, I don't want to say that he might not find evidence. All we know is that to date, after almost a year's worth of working on this, he hadn't found anything, that any evidence of any kind of actual collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. One of the problems with special counsels, just like the old independent counsels, like, you know, Ken Starr, people like that under the old statute, which is no longer in place, is that, look, these counsels have this, it's like almost a conflict of interest. They have a need to justify their existence because they're spending a lot of taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. And if they close off their investigation and say, well, we didn't find anything, I think they're all afraid that people are going to say, well, you wasted all your time and money. And so we keep having these indictment after indictment after indictment coming out on things peripheral to what his purpose was. And so far, like I said, nothing to actually support what he's supposed to be looking at.
Hans, I have not asked you, and I want to, what you think about Rod Rosenstein and his, the pieces I'm putting together is his involvement in so many of these really bad activities, there's kind of a link. He was, U.S. attorney out of Maryland during the sale of 20% of America's uranium to the Russians.
Uranium One.
He was, his name is right in there. He was a party to that taking place. He's also very closely connected with FBI Director Mueller. So he appoints him to be immediately to be the head of this, to be a special counsel. Where did that come from? Was that Rod Rosenstein's idea, you think? Did he just think that was a great idea? And was that, it just seems to me, looking from the outside, that he's part of this whole network, even if he's not a very type A player, but he's a key player, it seems.
Well, look, I know Rod Rosenstein. I've known him for a number of years. What I will say is that I think he's approaching a potential conflict of interest. And the conflict of interest is that, remember, the House Intelligence Committee is investigating the application for a FISA warrant. Remember, this was the application that justified a court in issuing a warrant that allowed electronic surveillance of the Trump transition team. And he was one of the people that signed off on the renewal of that application.
That's right.
And there are a lot of questions now being asked about whether that was a valid application, because they were relying on unverified, uncorroborated opposition research paid for by the Clinton campaign. So that's something that the House Intelligence Committee is looking at. I hope the Inspector General is looking at. And I think there's a potential conflict of interest there that might lead him to have to recuse himself from any more involvement with this.
So who's going to make that decision? If the Attorney General is recused from these decisions, and who's going to ask Rod Rosenstein to recuse himself?
Well, he would have to do that himself. Like I said, I'm not saying that he needs to do it, but it looks like he might get to the point where he has to. In that case, then all the decision-making and supervision of Bob Mueller would fall to the number three slot.
Who has just resigned.
Who has just resigned to take a position at, I think, Walmart. So it's...
And the Justice Department is already in a hold by, so many of the appointments are on hold because of the Cory Gardner, the U.S. Senator from Colorado, because he's not happy with the Justice Department's treatment of marijuana law in Colorado.
Yeah, which in itself is really odd, because he's a member of Congress. If he doesn't like the federal law on marijuana, change it. But he's upset because the Justice Department, whose job it is to enforce the laws passed by Congress, that Jeff Sessions wants to actually enforce the law. It is one of the most hypocritical things I have ever seen by a member of Congress.
Well, let me just say that Hans has just written a very interesting article about this indictment of the 13 Russians that we want to commend to you. We'll put it on our Facebook page so that you can read it. All right, Hans, we just have a minute left. What's the most positive spin you can be on how we could sort this out at the Justice Department? How could that happen?
Well, what ought to happen is that the Republicans in the Senate ought to quit to have a real recess You know, they've done pro forma sessions. Why? To keep President Trump from doing recess appointments. I can understand why you'd want to do that with a Democratic president. Why would you do that with your own president in the White House? Because what ought to happen while these nominations are pending is recess appoint all these people into these slots at the Justice Department.
Gee, Senator Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader McConnell, I just have no idea what he's up to. I can't imagine, unless it's stopping the people's president from doing what he needs to do. It really is disgraceful all across the board. Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Policy Advisor of Heritage. Hans, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you in person.
Yeah, thank you. Great to see you in person, too. Coming up, Frank Gaffney and Ambassador John Bolton. Don't go away. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you here at CPAC 2018. And one of the great privileges, of course, at being at CPAC is to get to connect with people in person, especially when they're friends. And the next person you're going to hear, you hear every morning on my show. Frank hits the mark every single morning, Frank Gaffney, with a commentary that's salient to what's happening in the day. And Frank, I can't tell you how often, you know, your commentary is just exactly what I'm talking about. It's funny. It's like somehow like we kind of think the same thing sometimes, but
ESP.
Yeah, ESP, that's right. Frank Gaffney, of course, is the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy. He began his professional career in Washington, as far as I can tell, as a staffer on the Hill, and then grew up to be at the Department of Defense, Assistant Secretary of the Army, the Navy?
No, Defense.
Of Defense.
Acted in that capacity.
Yes.
Under President Reagan.
Under President Reagan, so that's a pretty good training ground for the kinds of things you do now, Frank. Thanks for joining me this morning.
It's always a delight. Thank you.
You know, Frank, I have touched on this topic so many times, but never really had a chance to sit and flesh it out. And so I want us, you and me, to do that for the benefit of our audience. Before Barack Obama left office, really, as a ninth hour, 11th hour deal, he suddenly decided to allow transgender persons to join the military. And remember, it was Ash Carter, who made that decision, and we were just dumbstruck. I just have to intersect a visual. My husband and I were just in a grocery store in the D.C. area a few nights ago, and a young man walked in, very slender, with lace hose, lace tights, high heels, real flowy dress with flowy, kind of like I have, with lacy arms, a backpack, and a full beard and head of hair. And he was in the grocery store. And I have to tell you that regardless of what is politically correct, that will never be normal. It is offensive to the eye, it's odd, it's strange, and those are the kinds of people that are being recruited and brought into our military. And as you and I both know, I think the military, our friend Elaine Donnelly pointed out to us, has like a 7-page document on how to even manage underwear for transgender troops. It has, besides the bathroom issue, women are being instructed on how to shower, that they're going to be forced to shower with men in various stages, and that they have no choice. No choice. They will bunk with them. They will shower with them. This is the state of things. So President Trump gets elected. He comes in and he issues, first he tweets that transgenders will not be allowed. He's ridiculed for that. Then it's followed by a written order. And then a judge, a lower court judge, interjects and says he can't do that. That's not right. So that's where we are. Updating to today, this judge's order is in place. And as of the first of this year, transgender soldiers are now being again admitted into the military. All right, Frank, that's the backdrop on this. First of all, with your expertise, what would you say, beyond what I've described, about what this does to the military?
Sandy, let me just make one point, because I think it's important to preface my comments by saying I believe what Barack Obama was doing throughout his term was a wrecking operation against the United States military. I think it was of a piece with the whole notion of fundamentally transforming America, because it after all, was one of our most revered institutions in this country. And so you said, you know, he did it on his way out the door. Literally, that's true. But I believe he knew full well when he engaged in one of the earlier acts of social engineering at the military's expense, namely allowing avowed and open homosexuals to serve. We were told at the time, well, this is not going to conduce to having transgender individuals. But, of course, I think that was the agenda all the way along.
Of course.
So to your question, I think it doesn't take any imagination at all, if you think about it. Unfortunately, most of us have so little exposure to the military and what military life is like and what kinds of, well, sacrifices are entailed, but even just the basic day-to-day lack of privacy for most people, particularly when they're, you know, deployed overseas in difficult circumstances. To think that people who have what is clinically called gender dysphoria, which is a psychological disorder, and it's not to be critical of them. I think we should treat this with compassion. It's just to say it has properly, to this point, been regarded as one of the things that makes you ineligible for military service. It should still make you ineligible for military service, and I think that's what the president has said. Unfortunately, it's not just one federal judge who has decided that, notwithstanding the Constitution's very clear establishment of the Article II powers for the Commander-in-Chief being solely vested in the President, not vested in the President and the Congress, not vested in the President and the Judicial Branch, let alone in the Judicial Branch, you know, over and above the President of the United States. This is nonsense, and it is anti-constitutional, and it is creating, I think, a constitutional crisis. So what we're facing is two things. One, a constitutional crisis involving the authority of the president, because you know full well, Sandy, I mean, just think about it. If a federal judge can get away with saying, despite the commander-in-chief's direction, who can serve in the military, it will surely be the case that some federal judge, some point, probably not in the too distant future, will say, well, actually, you can't use the people I've said need to be in the military in such and such a way. And that may mean going to war,
right?
A veto by a federal judge. The second thing is, this is part of the wrecking of the United States military. As you say, that memo that Elaine Donnelly, who has been just magnificent on this issue, she has tirelessly stood up for men and women who basically, despite being citizens of this country, despite being people who are actually defending it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, they are silenced. They're not allowed to talk about these things. And those voices need to be heard, because what's happening in showers, what's happening in bunk rooms, what's happening in bathrooms, what's happening, you know, in the day-to-day interactions between people in circumstances where there is no privacy, are a train wreck. And the thing is that worries me most is this is an all-volunteer force. We're going to find good people not being willing to put up with this.
Well, who would be? Would you be willing? What if in your workplace it was happening? I wouldn't.
I would not.
You know, so we know this is disruptive in every way, the most personal levels.
Right.
And it's the personal things that, you know, things need to be right at home. You have, you know, underwear and your socks on matching. You know, there are some basics of life that need to be in place before you can actually do big jobs. We can't live in total chaos in our private world and function in these big responsibilities. But so Frank, as I have explained to my audience, the Pentagon is infiltrated with these kinds of people, and they're sympathetic to it. And so-called Mad Dog Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, has been abysmal on this issue. Describe for us his actions that he has or hasn't taken.
The Secretary of Defense, for most of his tenure so far, has seemingly tried to accommodate the social engineering wrecking operation, I call it, of President Obama. And when President Trump said, we're not going to do this, Secretary Mattis, on the transgender issue, immediately came back and said, well, hold on, we're actually not going to fulfill that order as it relates to the people who are already in the military. And we'll think about what we're going to do about people who might want to become members of the United States Armed Forces.
Can I just say, how dare he?
Well, it was deeply troubling, especially given that this is a man who has spent, with considerable distinction, to be sure, his entire life following orders, issuing orders too, but also following orders through the chain of command, including from the commander-in-chief. This was very troubling. Now, having said all that, Sandy, I was even more troubled by the entrusting to a former Navy admiral by the name of Curta, Anthony Curta, I believe his first name is, the responsibility to do the study that would inform what the Pentagon would do, perhaps even at direct odds with the president's order. This gentleman, I take nothing away from his service to our country either, but he has been deeply invested in this whole lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, I don't even know what Q stands for.
Queer.
Agenda.
Stands for
but,
queer.
But this is not an objective, independent source for giving the military's leadership the best advice on the subject. He's a partisan, in other words. Now, having said all of that, which is profoundly troubling, and I think you, like many of us, have been, and by the way, a great many men and women who have served their country who are now out and free to speak. There were 43 of them, I believe, who signed a letter that was circulated by something called the Conservative Action Project recently. I don't know if you signed it.
Yes,
I did.
Yes.
Elaine did. Others of us. But 43 former senior military leaders said this is not acceptable. The transgender issue in the military is not acceptable. I'm taking some heart, having said all that I have, that General Mattis last weekend, I believe, announced a new policy. He said, if you can't be deployed, with several very specific and narrow exceptions, you must get out of the military. Now, the reason for that is, of course, that there have been a disproportionately heavy burden, has been a disproportionately heavy burden placed on relatively small numbers of men and women in the armed forces, because lots of other people are, for a variety of reasons, not deployable.
And
notably,
some of them,
they're pregnant,
some of them,
and so on.
Yeah, and some of them are in of this category, and are on some, hormones,
and some of
in
them,
transition for surgeries.
Exactly, and that's the point. If this if this policy is now going to be faithfully implemented, people who spend 6 months or more going through one phase or another of treatment or counseling and are not deployable, they must get out.
All right, so
that ought to be the basis, it seems to me, for fulfilling the president's order.
So you, we don't know for sure, but you are hopeful that this may be a good sign.
The president, as I understand it, and the vice president met with General Mattis on this issue yesterday.
Okay.
We've not heard anything about it. My fingers and toes are crossed, Sandy, that the president, when he comes to CPAC tomorrow, is going to tell us that the order he lawfully gave as the commander-in-chief will now be implemented in the United States military, and the process that he's determined to pursue of rebuilding it, not only in terms of its materiel and readiness, but in terms of its morale, will go forward without any further skullduggery or sabotage.
And let me just tag to emphasize, we don't know that, but that's what we're hoping for.
My prayers are going that way.
All right, Frank, as always, you have your heart and your mind in so many different areas. And I need to just be practical before I go to this next area, because we're going to run out of time here. You're starting a new show. on American Family Radio.
I am.
And here we are to announce it, maybe first.
We're a little premature. We haven't signed all the dotted T's and so on.
Am I premature?
Well, I think we're a little premature. We have an agreement in principle to join you on this wonderful network, and I couldn't be more pleased.
Well, I couldn't either. I think that's it's a great addition to our team. So, all right, we'll save the specifics for later. All right, so Frank, this next thing that you are involving yourself in is called Stand with Persecuted Christians. And the logo is a logo in Arabic, which means?
It's the letter N in Arabic, or Nun, as they pronounce it, that is the first letter of the Arabic word Nazarene, which is meant as a pejorative, I'm told, way to describe Christians. And it has, of course, been made into a symbol right up there, really, with now the cross and the fish of the persecuted Christians around the world. And they are around the world. It happens this is an Arabic letter, and it happens that it was painted on the doors of Christians by ISIS in Iraq and Syria as they expelled Christians from their homes and raped and tortured and enslaved and in many cases murdered them. But it's meant to be a symbol of persecution worldwide. And the actual title of the operation is Save the Persecuted Christians. We want to stand with him for sure. I'm very proud to be one of the members of this coalition, Sandy, and it's come together just in the space of the past month. Last week, a week ago yesterday, we rolled it out with a number of banners being placed outside of churches across America. There are some 200 plus now that are in the pipeline and will be deployed. I believe many, many more will as well. If people want to find more information out about it, I hope they'll go to SaveThePersecutedChristians.org. And in particular, if they'd like to find out how they can get a banner for their church, a free banner, one per customer, for their church to be deployed outside prominently so that people can get the message, Save the Persecuted Christians, they can go to info@SaveThePersecutedChristians.org.
Okay, we'll put this on our Facebook page so that people can refer to it. But, all right, so is the idea, Frank, to do anything practical or to just make a statement in solidarity that we need to help them?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sandy. The purpose of this coalition is basically to raise the level of awareness in this country about this phenomenon. As you see here, one of the groups we work with, Open Doors, has estimated that 215 million Christians around the world are suffering from heavy persecution. And most Americans, I think, are still clueless that that could possibly be the case, at least on that scale. What we're hoping to do is two things. Most immediately is to take that heightened awareness and enlist people in helping the many groups, Open Doors being just one of them, that are actually in the field working to try to alleviate the condition of these poor Christian folks. The other step, though, which is an ambition, to be sure, but all of this started, interestingly enough, Sandy, with a campaign that was very successfully mounted back when you and I were youngsters to save Soviet Jewry. Yeah. And what came of that ultimately, believe it or not, a couple of Jewish activists putting signs saying free the Soviet Jews outside of synagogues and some churches was a movement. And that movement translated with the help of a man I happily had a chance to work for by the name of Scoop Jackson into a mechanism that created leverage that blocked the Soviet Union from getting what it desperately needed, which was most favored nation status and kind of financial life support.
So that's
and that turned into, shortly thereafter, the decisive vulnerability that Ronald Reagan, who I also, as you mentioned, had the privilege of working for, decisively exploited as part of a strategy of taking the Soviet Union down, which resulted in the liberation not just of Soviet Jews, but of countless hundreds of millions of other people. The point being, as a friend of mine said, so you're telling me a couple of Jewish guys with signs brought down an empire. And in a way, yeah, it did, and that's the inspiration here. We want to stop this kind of persecution, if we can, by holding those doing it accountable. So
and of course,
that's what the movement hopefully will be about.
Yeah, so, and the idea, of course, is to make it part of our DNA.
Yes.
In this country, so that it's just the natural fertile soil through which legislation and other efforts would spring. So it's a stand with persecuted Christians, stand with persecuted Christians if you
that's
would
the
like
message.
One of these.
Just to not confuse people. That's what we want people to do. This is where we want them to do it.
Okay.
Save the persecuted Christians.org.
Okay. Save the persecuted Christians.org. And again, we'll put that on our Facebook page. Frank Gaffney, thank you. We appreciate everything you do to enhance and enrich our understanding of what's going on in the world. You do it for us every single morning. So thank you
Thanks
so
for
much.
For letting me do it.
All right. Sandy Rios coming to you live from CPAC 2018. Stay tuned.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
One of my favorite guests always and forever is Ambassador John Bolton. And I have to always say that our paths crossed first when I came back from North Korea and became president of Concerned Women for America, and became the first chairman of the North Korea Freedom Coalition. And Ambassador Bolton was, of course, very vested in that issue, and that's how we began to be acquainted. And so it's been an honor to know him since that time. Ambassador, I don't know, you know, one of my most frustrating things, this is kind of a sore spot, it's a bad way to start the interview, but I am so disappointed that you are not in the White House. That will be forever to be a disgrace to me, although I have it on good authority that they do listen to you in other ways, so I'm very grateful about that.
Well, hopefully they're listening to the show right now.
Yes, yes, Mr. President, I think you should hire John Bolton officially. That's my word. I don't know why he doesn't listen to me. But John, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right, let's just jump right in because you have limited time. This is very curious to me, this whole notion that North Korea wants to now allegedly unify with South Korea. And of course, they're there, you know, the games are there and all the attention is on. I can't even imagine them. Yes, I can imagine them imagining that because they're delusional, but I can't imagine the South's response to that. Do you think there's any possibility that that might ever happen?
Well, it could happen, in my view, if we did it on our terms. That is to say, South Korea essentially takes over North Korea and Kim Jong-un's regime disappears. But the North Koreans are expert at propaganda. As you know, this whole affair at the Olympics has been a propaganda campaign. It succeeded, unfortunately, because there are many people in South Korea who still adhere to what they used to call the sunshine policy, and they think if they're just nice enough to the regime in North Korea that everything will work out.
Wait a second. Isn't that what our State Department here does with most of the world?
That's what they're...
There's their sunshine policy.
And they're doing it on North Korea right now. Yeah. I mean, the fact is the North would like to take over South Korea on their terms, and if they get a nuclear weapons capability, I think they'll try and blackmail us to remove American troops and leave South Korea more vulnerable. A lot of people in South Korea don't appreciate that threat. Unfortunately, a lot of people in the United States don't appreciate it either. I think the president gets it. I think that's why he sent Vice President Pence, who did a great job in reassuring the South Koreans, but not giving an inch to the North Koreans. And once the Olympics are over, we'll be right back where we were before. The North Koreans are very close to getting the capability to hit any American city with a thermonuclear weapon. CIA Director Mike Pompeo has said they're within a handful of months of that. We don't know exactly what that means, but it's not years, that's for sure. It could be sometime this year. So we're running out of time and options. The president really is facing, on North Korea and a whole range of other issues, due bills that are coming due because of the failures of the Obama administration. So he's got some hard decisions to make.
You know, it just occurs to me as you're talking, you and I have had this conversation since 2002, I would guess, where
at least,
you said, at least you and me, you talked about we have to stop North Korea. We have to stop them. We have to stop them. We have to stop them. You said it to the Bush administration, and they did nothing. Because I guess they were just so overwhelmed with the war in the Middle East that they just didn't want to take it on. But it has festered that long and been allowed to get to this point.
Well, one of the sad things is that really over the Clinton, Bush 43, and Obama administrations, we had multiple opportunities to stop North Korea, and we missed all of them. So just a couple months ago, Susan Rice, who was Barack Obama's national security advisor, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, well, you know, we tried for 25 years. I guess we failed. So too bad about that. Let's just accept North Korea with nuclear weapons. I do not accept North Korea with nuclear weapons, and no American should, because of the threat to us, not only from North Korea directly, but from the near certainty, in my view, that North Korea will sell that nuclear technology to anybody with the hard currency to buy it. Iran, just to get started, ISIS or Al-Qaeda if they could, any other would-be nuclear weapon state. It is a global threat, but it's principally a threat to us.
All right, so do you think, the president obviously is an unusual leader. Our current president, except for Teddy Roosevelt, I don't think there's anyone anywhere near like him. He has unusual ways, he's not a politician, he tweets in politic words. And he's gone after Kim Jong-un, which is very strange, you know, and odd. And everyone's, the establishment in Washington's raised their eyebrows and thought that was terrible. But personally, I think it's had its effect. I don't know if you feel that way. I think it's actually been the unorthodox thing that needed to happen.
Yeah, look, I think it took a while to convince North Korea and the rest of the world that we weren't still in the Obama presidency. And we've still got senior advisors to the president who talk about a negotiated outcome on the nuclear question. It's not going to happen. I wish we could be more optimistic. But negotiating with North Korea has been tried for 25 years and failed. There's no evidence to think year 26 is going to be different. Trump has made it clear when he says all options are on the table that he means it. And, you know, what people need to appreciate is the more serious the American threat becomes, the greater the likelihood there could be a peaceful resolution. It's when they think we're not serious that they ignore it.
One concern that I'm sure you share with me is those two ships that, as my understanding is, they both had these terrible accidents in the vicinity around North Korea. Sailors were killed, and the ships have been just really, I don't know if any of them are repairable. And my understanding was that they were part of our plan in terms of attacking North Korea. So now we have this huge influx of money into the defense budget, the potential to replace, but it takes a lot of time to do that. Are we even capable, seriously, of stopping North Korea from launching one of these handfuls away weapons that aimed at our country? Can we stop them now?
Yeah, we're capable of it now, but that's why the time dimension is so important, because our intelligence is not perfect. I mean, it's far from perfect, to be honest. And so you don't want to miss on the wrong side. You don't want to say, well, we've got 6 months and it turns out you had 1 month. Better to err on the wrong, on the long side. But it shows why we're going to see a compressed decision-making exercise here, because you don't want to take the chance you could be wrong. So if it's possible, we're going to have to see a concentration of U.S. forces, and it's going to put a great strain on the force worldwide. It's why, after all these years of budget cuts under Obama, the Trump budget is an important step to get the military back where it needs to be.
Were you all right? I'm just curious. Some would say that was just absolutely exorbitant, the amount of money given to the military. Are you in that camp?
No, it's the beginning of a down payment. It's like the Reagan administration after the Carter administration. Now, everybody is concerned. We don't want to increase the budget deficit or the national debt. I fully support that. To me, what it means is cut more out of the wasteful domestic programs that Obama built up. I agree we need to keep the deficit down, and that's what I would do. We need to go after the entitlement programs at some point, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. They need to be reformed. Mm-hmm. But to shortchange the military budget really has much longer-term consequences. So I think it's important to keep that as the top priority. There are a lot of issues that are on people's minds, understandably, but, you know, if the country's not safe, all the other issues are secondary.
Yeah. John, before we run out of time, I remember being with you when you launched this, actually, some event. But it was the John Bolton Super PAC. You launched it a few years ago.
Right. How long 2013, ago? Right.
Yeah. So Ambassador, you've been very busy, especially in Wisconsin, the Senate race. Tell us about what you're working on there.
Well, we're doing independent expenditures on behalf of Kevin Nicholson, a Marine veteran, a fellow who was a Democrat, signed up after 9/11, became a Republican. He's a businessman in Wisconsin now, running against Tammy Baldwin, trying to get the Republican nomination. He's kind of the case study of what I'm looking to support, what we've done in prior elections, people who understand why a strong American position in the world is so critical. In the 2016 cycle, all of our efforts, we raised a little bit over $12.5 million, and I think we're going to do much better than that this time around. And I think November, we're going to see national security have a very prominent role in the election. And this is an issue Republicans can win on. It's important policy, but it's good politics, too.
All right. Well, John, it's always a pleasure. Always. What's next for you? Are you, you're writing, whatever. Tell us what we need to know so people can follow you.
Well, I think if you look at boltonpack.com or aei.org, all my op-eds and whatnot are up there. But the national security threats from nuclear proliferation, international terrorism are right at the top of the agenda.
Okay. Ambassador John Bolton. Thank you, John.
Glad to be with you.
Always a pleasure. Sandy Rios, it's been a pleasure with spending time with all of you today at CPAC 2018.